Welcome to the City Club of Eugene's November 17th, 2017 program, Firearms, Rights, and Risks. We have today two members of our state legislature here to discuss their positions on the appropriate balance between the risks to the public from firearms and the individual right to bear arms. This is the 11th program in our 2017-2018 programming year. I'm Sandra Bishop, City Club President. The club, City Club, brings together civic-minded people to make Eugene a better place to live, work, and play. We are a member-supported nonprofit. Our members have a direct influence on public policy. Become a member at cityclubofeugene.org. Support for City Club is provided by our members and sponsors, including LULAC, the League of United Latin American Citizens, Luvas Cobb, Attorneys at Law, Network Charter School, and one of our Sapphire sponsors, Johnson Johnson Lucas and Middleton, PC. The law offices of Johnson Johnson Lucas and Middleton's mission is to obtain justice and fair compensation for people who've been harmed because of someone's wrongful conduct. More information at justicelawyers.com. And we also want to extend special thanks to PacInfo Internet Solutions and KLCC Radio. City Club programs are broadcast on public radio station KLCC 89.7 at 6:30 on Monday following the program. The City Club of Eugene wants to welcome a new gold sponsor, Dr. Movasagi Plastic Surgery and Ziba Medical Spa. The coordinator for today's program is Marty Wilde. Thank you to Marty for organizing this important discussion. And I'd like to turn it over to Marty to introduce our speakers. Thank you.
Thank you, Sandra. Our first speaker today is Representative Mike Nierman. Mr. Nierman was raised in Oregon and attended Jesuit High School in Portland. After graduating from Marquette University in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, he returned to Oregon to help with the family office furniture business. He also completed a degree in computer science from Western Oregon University. Mike lives with his wife, Debbie, and loves waterfowl hunting and can be seen in the wintertime patrolling the Willamette River in a kayak in a quest for ducks and geese. He has served as the chair of the Polk County Republican Party and is still active as a precinct committee person. He is a member of the Board of Directors of Oregonians for Immigration Reform and serves on the Central School District Budget Committee. He was elected to the State House in 2014. Please welcome Representative Mike Nierman.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the introduction, and thanks to the City Club for having me and for putting on this debate. This is really truly what makes America great, is having forums like this. And I love your slogan here on your program. It says building community vision through open inquiry. So I'm happy and honored to be a part of that. So thanks for inviting me. So today's topic is firearms, and we have to go back in history. In 1787 was when the Second Amendment was framed. And one of the cool things about the Second Amendment is they not only said what the right was, but they said why we need the right. And they didn't say you have a Second Amendment right to go target shooting, and they didn't say you have a Second Amendment right to hunt deer or anything like that. They said you have a Second Amendment right to protect the security of a free state. And so that gives a little bit of context for that. And then several years later, when Oregon became a state, Oregon put its own version of firearm rights into its own state constitution and expanded the idea a little bit more. And one of the reasons that you have a right to own a firearm in Oregon is not just for the security of a free state, that kind of thing. It's for defending yourself and your family. So that's Article 1, Section 27 of the Oregon Constitution. So this is... Both of those amendments were written, or both of those sections of law were written before the current time, and part of the context of the current time is that we have these horrible incidents of gun violence, and we need to do something about that. And there's different thoughts on what we need to do about that and what'll be effective. And so I'm happy to bring one perspective on them. One of the perspectives that I think is pretty important is that not just from all the statistics and everything of what's effective, but it's the fundamental fact of that I have a right to defend myself, and that even if it might be effective to take my firearms away from me, that it's not right or fair to put me in a situation where I'm unable to defend myself and my family. And so I think that that's a pretty important thing to consider. We have other things going on in society that cause these gun violent incidents, and I think it's not so much just the existence of firearms, because we've had firearms throughout the history of our nation, and it's, I don't think it's even the type of firearms, but we have other things going on that I think we need to look into, and we don't look into enough. One of them is just the prevalence of mental illness that we have. So we have people who have untreated mental illness, and that's an issue. And it seems to me that's kind of a growing thing. We used to institutionalize people, and we made a decision back in the 80s and 90s to not do that, or not do that as much as we're doing that now, and that has a consequence. We have our children. We give them psychotropic drugs to control their behavior more so now, and that seems to be an incident, a contributor to these incidents. We also have illegal and semi-legal recreational drugs that have a high usage, and that contributes to this. So we have all kinds of things. We have the breakdown of the family. We have all kinds of things that we need to work on to solve these problems and others. But I think that most of the legislation that I see coming forward, that I've seen come forward, and that I see coming up in the future, is to take away gun rights. And I'm just not sure that that's the right path to take. I think that arguably nearly every case of these horrible violent things, the end point was caused by a person who was in possession of a firearm, and a good guy in possession of a firearm. And I think we need to recognize that and make sure that we don't take away all the firearms from the good guys and leave the firearms only in the hands of the bad guys. So I look forward to hearing your questions and to hearing the senator's comments. And thanks very much again for having me.
Thank you, Representative Nierman. Our next speaker is State Senator Floyd Prozanski. Senator Prozanski was first elected to the Oregon Legislature in 1994. He served in the House of Representatives between 1995 and 2000 and 2003 before being appointed to represent Oregon Senate District 4 in 2003. He was elected in 2004 to complete the current term and has been reelected three times since 2006. Senator Prozanski graduated from the Texas A&M University and later earned a law degree from the South Texas College of Law. An avid cyclist and homebrewer, he lives in Eugene with his wife. During the interim, Floyd works as a municipal prosecutor and serves on various legislative committees, work groups, and commissions. Please welcome State Senator Floyd Prozanski.
I too want to thank the City Club for giving me and Mike this opportunity to be here. These are opportunities for we can have discussions. And I don't see this as a debate. I see this as an opportunity for us to put concepts, philosophies out there and kind of decide on what's right for us as Oregonians. I will start off with where Mike began as to the protections that we already have that are given to us through the Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, as well as Article 1, Section 27 of the Oregon Constitution. If you gave me the choice of which of the two would I want, I would want the one that we have within our state constitution, because as Mike has said, it actually calls out specifically that you have the right to bear arms for self-defense. Now, the reason I wanted to bring that out and highlight that is because when you look at the Second Amendment, for over 150 years, we had interpretations that it did not apply to individual rights for self-protection. It wasn't until 2008 when the Heller decision came down and Anthony Scalia, who was the opinion writer, actually made it very clear from his perspective that individuals under the federal constitution did in fact have that same protection. But it's very, very important for us to remember what he put in that opinion and what it actually states. And it basically says that states still have the right to actually limit access of firearms, just like we have limitations on other First Amendment or other amendments within the Bill of Rights. Basically, that you can, in fact, limit individuals from having access to firearms. Specifically, as the opinion says, no one should interpret this opinion to say that the states do not have the continued ability to regulate and limit firearms to felons or those who have been mentally, that have suffered mental illness. And basically our court, our state has said that that means that they have to be adjudicated by a court that they are in fact having mental illness. It's not some other way, so in other words, there's due process there. Now with that framework, let me go back and kind of give you some historical perspective of what's happened in this state. In 1925, the Oregon legislature passed legislation prohibiting felons from possessing concealable firearms. Basically, what I'm speaking about at that time and what the courts were relying on were handguns. Unless a court actually gave an individual relief from that prohibition. So over the next 92 years, the legislature as well as citizens of Oregon have actually passed legislation or citizen initiatives to enforce the prohibition of keeping felons from possessing firearms. In 1989, the current statute that we have today, which is ORS 166.270, was amended to prohibit felons from possessing all firearms. So previously, prior to that time, it was specifically a type of gun, but in 1989, the legislature extended this to all firearms. At the same time, the legislature also passed that year legislation requiring all transfers of firearms to occur through a license dealer to have a background check. So this was the very beginning of background checks in the state of Oregon, so 1989. So basically, if you went and bought a gun from a dealer at a retail outlet, you had to go through a background check. That left all the other type of transfers open without needing to have a background check. In 1995, when I first started serving in the legislature, we passed what's known as the InstaCheck system, where you could actually call in and determine whether or not a person was eligible or not eligible to have a gun transferred to them. Moving forward to November 2000, the citizens of this state passed a measure that was expanding the background checks beyond just what was happening in the retail store and said that all transfers at gun shows would also be required to have a background check. And I say all transfers at gun shows because what you need to realize is that at gun shows, it's not just retail dealers that are selling at the gun shows, it's individuals like myself or you who have the ability to transfer a weapon, a gun, to another person on a private sale. So since 2001, this state has had a requirement that any transfer of by a private citizen to a private citizen at a gun show had to go through a background check just like a retail operation. So if you think about that, here we are in a building. This is a location that we're having a gun show this weekend. If you walked outside under the street, you didn't have to have the background check of private to private, but you did inside the building. So for about 14 years, we attempted to try to understand what this really meant and how we could actually protect more individuals from individuals that have been prohibited by law, by a court, because they're either mentally incompetent or they are a felon from having easy access to guns. So in 2015, the legislature closed the final loophole on our background check law. Senate Bill 941 was passed that basically said all private transfers would in fact require a background check. So it didn't matter if it happened at a gun show, it didn't matter if it happened out in the parking lot of a retail operation or at your home, you have to now have a background check before you transfer that gun to an individual. Now, some people have said, does a background check actually work? What does it really do? So let me give you some numbers here. Did you know in 2016, there were 302,725 valid transfers that occurred in the state of Oregon? That's 302,725. That averages out to about 25,000 transfers per month in the state of Oregon last year. At the same time, we had 2,591 attempted transfers that were denied because the individuals were ineligible from having the gun transferred to them. So that comes out to about 200 per month of transfers that were not allowed to go forward because we have the background check law. And when we know that we established, as this state back in 1925, a prohibition for felons to having access to guns, this is a way that we were able to close a loophole and ensure that law is, has its full effect by limiting access to firearms or easy access for felons to get guns. So when we know that, then the question is, where do we go from here? And I will just have to give you a little bit of perspective. For myself, I've owned guns for 45 years. I bought my first shotgun when I was 15, growing up in Texas. And I also will share with you, I had a sister who was murdered by a felon with a handgun. And I really do think it's reasonable. I do think it's just common sense that we require background checks on all transfer of guns. Now, since then, we have looked at what other steps can we take or should we take that can, in fact, give more protections to individuals in this state. Specifically, during this last session, meaning the long session of 2017, we had a bill, Senate Bill 719. It was passed and signed by the governor, and it will go into effect this coming January 1st of 2018. Senate Bill 719 authorizes family members, household members, or law enforcement to petition a circuit court for an extreme risk protection order that would require individuals to have firearms removed from their possession when it is established in front of a court through a judicial proceeding that the person poses a elevated risk of violence to themselves or to others. This is only a temporary order, it's not a permanent ban, but it's a means to have individuals who are not able to maybe make the right decision because they're emotionally tied as in an extremely risk situation, and they may in fact use those guns in an inappropriate way. And I say inappropriate way, let's just look at some of the last mass shootings that have occurred that demonstrate that many of these individuals actually have that type of behavior. The one in Texas, which occurred 35 miles from where I grew up in Sutherland Springs. The individual there is documented to be sending threats to his ex-mother-in-law and having erratic behavior. A law enforcement officer who had that information or a family member, if they had that law in the state of Texas, would have been able to go to a court and say, I think Johnny is not able to make rational decisions. He has access to firearms and he's a risk to himself or to others. Why wouldn't we want to have those who are close enough to see somebody before they commit an act of such violence being able to go to a court and ask the court to intervene? Now, there is due process under the IRPA, which is, again, the Extreme Risk Protection Order process. If a person is actually ordered by the court to give up those weapons, they have an ability to go to the court and actually challenge that order. So we have due process. This is a balance. This is something that I feel and I want to protect anybody who has the lawful right to own guns, to have the recourse within our judicial system to make certain their rights are not being violated. And this is a way that we can do that. Now, I will tell you, I think it's time for Congress to take more actions than they have been taking. You know that every time we have a mass shooting, you hear individuals up on Capitol Hill saying that they're going to do this, they're going to do that, but nothing comes of it. I mean, at this point, based on what we know about semi-automatics, specifically military-styled semi-automatics that are in fact designed and manufactured to kill people, that we need to have greater regulations over those types of semi-automatics. Not all automatics are semi-automatics, but those that are designed and manufactured, like the AKs and the ARs. And the way that this can be done and the way it should be done is at the national level. We can't, in my opinion, be as successful on a state-by-state basis. Easily, Congress could do one simple thing. They could take those style of weapons, again, these are the military style of semi-automatics, and they could, in fact, have them reclassified and regulated just as we do today on fully automatic weapons like machine guns. It's a very simple step that could be done, and we would actually then have a unified practice across this country to ensure that those type of weapons that are designed to kill people are in fact being regulated at a level higher degree than what we do for hunters, individuals. So I think it's also important to look at what happened in Texas, Vegas, where you had the bump stock. This is a mechanism that you put on the back of the stock of the weapon. It sits up against your shoulder, and as you are firing, it's recoiling. And as it's recoiling, it's sending a message to the trigger, basically, to continue to fire, making it a fully, or for all intent purposes, a fully automatic weapon. So if that is what it does, why aren't we taking the steps that are sensible and reasonable to actually hold people accountable and make certain those type of weapons with those type of modifications are not getting in the wrong hands? So again, I ask and I hope that we in the legislature will take this issue up in the 2018 session, sending a resolution to the Congress and asking them to act to make certain that we take another reasonable safeguard to ensure that those type of weapons are in fact limited in the hands of people that we believe are sensible, reasonable, and rational in making decisions as it pertains to guns. Again, as a gun owner for over 45 years, I feel that this is a reasonable step, and this is something that we can do to help protect our families and our communities. Thank you.
Thank you very much to both of our speakers, Representative Mike Nierman and Senator Floyd Prozanski. We'll take a break now for about 5 minutes to formulate questions from each table and then return with audience questions. But today we're taking them in writing. So if you have a question, you can bring it up to the front table, write it on one of the cards or anything you have, or just wave it in the air and somebody will come pick it up. So we'll be back in 5 minutes. Thank you.
This is KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, 89.1 KLFR Reedsport, and at 88.1 KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, KLBR Bend. KLCC is a service of Lane Community College. We're on Facebook and Twitter and online at klcc.org.
Welcome back to the November 17th City Club program. Firearms, rights, and risks. If we could have our two speakers come forward. Today we have two members of the Oregon State Legislature here to discuss their positions on the appropriate balance between the risks to the public from firearms and the individual's right to bear arms. We have Senator Floyd Prozanski and Representative Mike Nierman. Thank you. So let me just finish the announcements and we'll get to the questions. City Club is a nonprofit organization. Support for City Club is provided by our members and sponsors, including LULAC, the League of United Latin American Citizens, Luvas Cobb, Attorneys at Law, Network Charter School, and one of our Sapphire sponsors, Johnson Johnson Lucas and Middleton PC. And special thanks to some of our in-kind sponsors, University of Oregon Academic Extension, who is where we're hosted here at the Baker Center, U of O Baker Center, and also Dot Dotson's Photography and KRVM 91.9 Radio. Before we go to member questions, I'd just like to thank Catherine Schott for helping us to organize the questions and vet them. And we have plenty of time for questions, so if anything comes to mind, keep writing and hold your questions up. Someone will pick them up or just bring them forward. Thank you. All right, we'll start with the first question I have is, should the state prohibit military weapons and bump stocks in the absence of federal legislation?
Floyd Prozanski, State Senator, District 4. As I stated in my presentation, I believe this would be most effective for us to be doing this at the national level. Whether or not a state should do this on a one on an individual basis, I believe is a decision that needs to be made at that level of the state. Personally, I want to see the federal government take the first step or have the first opportunity to do that. I would say at this point, based on what has happened in recent weeks, that they should be acting within the next year or 2 years. I mean, it should be yesterday from my perspective, but the reality, we know all of this takes a while. At that point, then I believe that then the states need to be looking at how do we make changes at the national level. This is not uncommon for other type of legislation when you look at environmental concerns and other areas where the states have taken the lead and actually have implemented. And then once you have enough states moving forward in a direction, the federal government sometimes catches up with this. Another area of an example of this would be in the area of cannabis. We're now seeing across the country, many people are now recognizing the value of industrial hemp and what something that was actually grown in this country by farmers at the request of the U.S. government is now coming back and making a stronghold for economic purposes. So, yes, I think those states should, in fact, consider using their ability to change federal law. But at this point, I'd like to see the federal government act and do their job first.
Great. Thank you. Representative Nierman.
Good. So I'm State Representative Mike Nierman from Independence. So this question had a couple different parts. One of them was, should we ban military-style weapons there? And I don't think the style of the weapon or that it's black and looks scary is really material to whether or not we should ban it or regulate it or anything. In the shooting in Texas, it's my understanding that actually the civilian who wounded the perpetrator on that actually used an AR-15. So it's probably a good thing that we didn't have that regulated so tightly that we took it away from him. So for military style weapons, I don't think that's really relevant. On the bump stocks, that's a technical modification to a firearm, and I have to admit that I had never heard of a bump stock until the Las Vegas shooting, and so I'm open to the possibility of if that technical modification truly creates effectively an automatic weapon, that it ought to be regulated as an automatic weapon. I'm open to that, but we need to look into that. As far as the federal government or the state government regulating it, there's pros and cons to both. If you get the federal government regulating it, you get one size fits all, and you don't get the experimentation that can go on with among the different states. If you have the states do it, then you get a 50-state patchwork of different regulations that are hard for manufacturers to work with and citizens who travel among states. So there's pros and cons on that.
Thank you. And next question we have is, why not regulate firearms like automobiles, where you educate, license, and then there's a regular renewal, and you require insurance? Why not treat firearms like automobiles?
So that's a good point, and we could do that. There's lots of things we could do. We could just ban firearms, but the Constitution's the founding fathers thought that you should have a right to bear arms. No right is absolute, so I don't think that if you're locked up in a penitentiary, we don't still extend to you the right to bear arms. So no right's absolute. So some regulation might be permissible. But I don't think that you don't have a right to drive an automobile. As a matter of fact, I think the DMV says that in the motor vehicle guide of how to drive an automobile. It says that driving a motor vehicle is not a right; it's a privilege. So I don't think it's really makes sense to regulate it in the same way.
It is true that it is not a right to drive an automobile. It is a privilege. But I would say to you, let's look at what the facts that we have before us and what the courts have said. Again, going back to the Scalia decision in the Heller in 2008, it was very clear in that opinion that the states, as well as the federal government, can, in fact, limit access to firearms to individuals. Specific individuals. In this context, felons and those who have mental illness and those who have been on the books in this state and many other states. So when you think about regulating it as you would as a person who wants to drop a vehicle. I use that analogy as well, because you go in and get your basic license for to drive a passenger vehicle. If you're going to be a commercial driver, you go through more training, more testing. You have different regulations to work with. And I think that's a fair assessment. We already have that within our firearms. Clearly, for a fully automatic weapon, a machine gun, you have to go through other steps than you have to do to get a non-fully automatic weapon. And as Mike says, when you start looking at some of the issues that we have and some of the apparatuses that are now available, you're basically taking a weapon that was not intended to be a fully automatic weapon, and then you're now making it a fully automatic weapon. And again, when you look at the styles of some of these military-style weapons, they are, in fact, designed to be used very quickly, very mobile, and they're used for basically combat in military situations. And I think that those type of weapons should, in fact, get a heavier, harder regulatory review than what you have for a non-fully automatic type of weapon. And it is something that we can, in fact, have differences within the state, but I do believe that it's better to have a universal plan in the country so we can have uniformity. Thank you.
Great. This is a rather philosophical question. The USA has more, quote, good guys with guns, end quote, than any other nation. Why, then, do we have such high rates of gun death among the developed world countries?
That is a good philosophy question here. I would just say that a gun is a means or a mechanism for a lot of certainty to occur in the sense of the end results are much more renowned. What we do know, and the unfortunate part, is that many individuals who commit suicide do in fact use a firearm. The stats show that it's more used by males, but there is an increase by females as well in using a firearm to commit suicide. This is one of the reasons I believe that this state has, in fact, this year passed the Extreme Risk Protection Order process for those individuals who are despondent for whatever reasons, for family members, for household members, or for law enforcement that come in contact with these individuals, to have a tool to go to a court to ensure that that individual is actually not going to hurt themselves or others. Again, what we have on the books now that goes into effect on January 1 of this next year will, in fact, ensure that individuals are basically competent and have not lost their rational sense of making decisions when it comes to use of a firearm. And we do believe that this will, in fact, curtail some of the needless, unwanted deaths that occur either with the individual directly or those who just happen to be in his path or her path.
Can you repeat the question, please?
Yes. The USA has more good guys with guns than any other nation. Why, then, do we have such high rates of gun death among countries in the developed world countries?
Good, thanks. And actually, the United States is kind of in the middle of the pack as far as gun deaths per capita with other developed nations. So I think that it's not so much the tool that's used, and we're starting to see now kind of one of the tools of choice is to use a rented truck or whatever and to drive through a crowd for, these mass murder kind of things. And in Great Britain, they have effectively outlawed firearms there, and they have quite a high incidence of knife violence there. And so I think that we run the danger of inordinate focus on the tool rather than on the problem of what it really is. It's the person that does the killing and not the firearm. To go back to the last question, too, it was brought up the topic of education. And I would support having firearms education as just part of the regular curriculum in the public schools. So that would be one way that we could begin to address these.
Great, thank you. Next question for both of you. Are there other states that have a bill similar to Senate Bill 719? If so, has it proved to be effective in other states? For instance, if the individual at risk finds out the court will be taking their guns, would it trigger them to act or to act more quickly?
Thanks. And so
this
I think
is Representative Mike Nierman.
State Representative Mike Nierman. So and the Senator Prozanski will correct me if I'm wrong, but the Senate Bill 719 was patterned after a law that went to the voters in the state of Washington. So it's almost identical to the law in the state of Washington, which, and again, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, I think that that law hasn't been on the books long enough to really give it a fair test of its effectiveness. To the point of, if let's say I am a veteran and I am a little bit down or not myself or something like that, I think I'm not a veteran, but some veterans may find comfort in the fact that they own firearms. And I think that if you have a person who's maybe has some issues and is maybe even arguably mentally unhealthy, that to have the police show up at their doorstep, and this would be the first time that they find out about it, and to have the police show up on their doorstep and say, "Hey, buddy, give us all your guns," that might not be the most helpful thing to do for that person there. So I'm wanting to help those people as much as possible, but I just don't know that this law is going to be the most effective way to do that.
The state of California passed a
this
similar...
This is Senator...
Senator Floyd Prozanski. the state of California did, in fact, pass a similar measure back in, I believe it was in 2016, if I'm not mistaken. It could have been 2015. This is going to be one of those issues that, knowing that what just happened in Northern California as to what happened and why that law wasn't used. I'm not familiar enough with the actual text and the means that they have in California, but my understanding is our Senate Bill 719 was modeled somewhat after the California law. What we do know, at least what I've read in the newspapers in the situation in Northern California, was you did have an individual that was truly demonstrating out-of-control behavior, firing multi-times from his residence. Officers actually had engaged the individual and had talked to him, as well as having other issues with his behavior. I'm not sure exactly why, or we'll probably hear it through the newspapers and through an investigation, why steps weren't taken under the California law to actually try to intervene before the actual shooting occurred. Regarding the ability for us to have this type of regulations, I think it is important. When you have individuals that are suffering from PTSD, what we have heard and what we've seen in actually some of the most recent mass shootings are individuals who were military trained. They did 3 or 4 tours abroad, and then they've come home, and as Mike says, we have not taken care of these individuals. We have not provided them with the mental health that they need. I think this is one of the things that the U.S. government should also require anyone who has served in the military, specifically those who have gone abroad, that they have some type of PTSD examinations before they are released from the military, so we know whether or not they need additional assistance. And if they do, that we provide them all of the assistance they need. It has to be extremely terrible for those individuals and their family members to have someone that walked out of their houses to represent us and protect us to come back and not be a whole person and not able to perform their duties within their own family because of the injuries that they've been scarred with because of their service to this country.
Thank you. This question is for Representative Nierman. Does Representative Nierman believe there are any problems with current gun laws, and if so, what are they?
Good, thanks. And I'm Representative Mike Nierman from Independence. So, I think there are some problems with gun laws. Again, we're trying to find a happy medium here, where we respect the rights of law-abiding people to exercise their rights to own arms. And on the other hand, we want to keep arms out of the hands of felons and mentally ill people. And we have to find a balance there, and that's what we're trying to do here. And that's what we try to do in the legislature. So so there's room for disagreement and argument on that. So we just passed Senate Bill 941. So this that was the one that said that you can't transfer a firearm to anybody else except for close family, and they had to slice and dice the definition of close family there, unless you get a background check done. And so there's some issues there of why the exceptions for the close family. I could transfer a firearm to my mentally ill brother or my mentally ill father or my without a background check. There's the situation where you have a friend of mine that I go duck hunting with, actually. He was involved in a divorce, and it wasn't part of Senate Bill 941 or Senate Bill 719, but it's the same situation where his ex-wife was getting a restraining order against him. He wasn't able to go hunting for 2 years. That was a pretty onerous restriction on his rights there, and I don't think he was any threat to anybody. So, I think that there's some we're focused too much on the tools and not so much on the people, and so I think we have gone a little bit overboard on some of those things.
Thank you. The next question: what safeguards are there currently in Oregon law to prevent those with existing or prior restraining orders against them from possessing firearms?
Floyd Przanski, State Senator. We already have on the books now where an individual that's coming in front of a court for whatever reasons, it could be if they are charged with a crime or if in a domestic situation, that the court can and does, in fact, in many cases, restricts a person's access and possession of firearms during the proceedings, depending on, it's a fact base, it's determined by the court, meaning a judge, on a case-by-case basis. So I would say we already have those tools available to us. Now, I think it's important to realize on the background check, as Mike has alluded to, there is a family exception, but that family exception doesn't mean that you have the right to transfer a gun to a family member that you know has mental illness or who you know is a felon. In fact, if you look at the legislation, the bill, the law, it basically calls out you have to have or you can't have that knowledge. If you know that an individual family member is not eligible to have a transfer of a gun, you can't transfer it to them. So there are safeguards there. Again, what we're trying to do is use reasonableness and standards as to how we protect individuals from unlawful activity and gun violence. And these are situations that we are balancing, and I would say by having a background check, you do in fact limit those transfers. Again, remember, just in year 2016, we had over 300,000 transfers of lawful transfers of guns in the state. That comes out to over 20,000 per month. I would tell you that if we're having that success of allowing me and you who are eligible to own a gun to be able to have access to a gun, we've done it. We've hit that mark. And at the same time, we're still keeping individuals that are prohibited when you are having about 200 per month trying to get a gun, going through a background check and being denied. I would say that it is working, and we have a balance that ensures that individuals who have the lawful right to possess can, in fact, get those guns that they want.
Thank you. This question follows a little bit on that. But Representative Nimmerman, did you want to respond to that as well? Okay. This will give you opportunity, too. This question is, we know that 54% of mass shootings are committed by people with a history of domestic abuse. Do you support legislation to restrict domestic abusers' access to firearms, including closing the boyfriend loophole and adding convicted stalkers to the restricted list?
So there's a couple of different things there. So, and again, I'm Mike Nierman from Independence. So the key there is convicted. So if we're going to take a right away from somebody, a constitutional right away from somebody, that it's very important that we have due process. And so that includes things like having the right to face your accusers and having a trial. It needs to be done by a judge. And so, yes, we want to keep the firearms out of the hands of convicted domestic abusers, that kind of thing. So, but we need to have due process on that. So that's a pretty important thing. With we passed Senate Bill 941, and as far as I know, there's only been one case where that's been brought up, and that was the pastor in Lake Oswego who won the AR-15 in a gun raffle there, and was going to have it pounded down into a work of art or something like that, and illegally transferred it to one of his parishioners there. And so this is the kind of silliness that we get into here when we're focused on the gun there, and that you can't transfer the gun, those kinds of things. We need to look on solutions for people that are focused on people, and we don't want guns in the hands of people that are adjudicated to be dangerous. So yes.
Thank you.
So Oregon law already provides for what's known as the Abuse Prevention Act, and under that Abuse Prevention Act, a court does in fact have the ability to limit access to guns to an individual that's accused of the crime. There is due process because it's an action or that occurs in front of a court in a judicial proceeding, and at that point the judge, he or she, makes a decision as to whether or not someone should or shouldn't be limited or have their access to weapons to be limited during the proceeding. Again, these are temporary orders that are in place, and then as Mike has said, if a person is in fact convicted, the court again has the authority to actually prohibit a person from having access to guns. Those are the type of issues that I think that we all agree that if someone has demonstrated a conduct that's not rational and reasonable, that put people at risk, that we want to take steps that are reasonable to keep them from being able to hurt others as well as themselves. And I do believe that the courts at this point do in fact have that authority, and they do in many cases exercise that on a day-to-day basis.
Thank you. Next question for both speakers. Please provide your interpretation of, quote, well-regulated militia, end quote, this phrase, which is part of the U.S. Constitution, and please comment on its applicability to today's gun debate.
So a well-regulated militia, that has been, let's say, discussed, argued, debated, or however you want to put it, for many, many years and decades. Again, this is Floyd Prezonsky, state senator. This is one of those areas that my intention, my belief, when the founders of our republic actually put this together in our Constitution and the Bill of Rights, that they basically were looking at how do we maintain that the commonwealths have the ability to actually over defend itself and make certain that you didn't have an oppressive central government. So basically, from my perspective, it was for the protection of the greater good of the whole, not the individual. And when you look at the historical perspective and the interpretations of the cases that have come down through the U.S. Courts, and I'm meaning the federal courts as compared to state courts, you do in fact have individual decisions that have been made that basically said that no one had the right to rely on the Second Amendment for self-protection and under that theory up until 2008 when the Heller decision came forward. But then again, Anthony Scalia, one of the most conservative jurists that we've had on our courts, basically made it very, very clear that those type of regulations were in fact still viable and still legal, and that states could in fact limit the a person's right to bear arms if they were felons or if they had been committed under a mental illness through a due process procedure.
Thank you.
Good. This is State Representative Mike Nierman again. So a well-regulated militia, and I think that we hear the word militia today, and I don't know, I think of guys in tactical gear and all that kind of stuff. I don't think that's what the Founding Fathers were talking about. What I think the Founding Fathers were talking about is they were talking about all of us, about you and me, about that not State Representative Mike Nierman, but just citizen Mike Nierman goes out and he hunts ducks and geese, and with sometimes a little bit of success, but he knows how to operate his firearm like that. And because of that, that causes the Japanese in World War II to not want to invade America, because they know that there's too many guys out there like Mike Nierman who hunt deer and elk and ducks and geese and know how to operate a firearm. And if so, he's going to run into me. And he might run into me as a member of the regular army, and he might run into me as a member of the Oregon National Guard, or he might run into me as just Mike Nierman protecting his own backyard. And so that's what I think that they were thinking of when they wrote well-regulated militia. That's just my opinion, and you know, you always get your money's worth when you get my opinion.
All All right. This is a question for both of you. Mental illness, this questioner asserts, is not a medical category, and all felonies are neither violent nor involve guns. How are these exclusionist variables defined, and how are background checks compiled? So I guess it gets to the heart of why would you prohibit all felons from having guns, and how are background checks compiled?
That's a good point. And this again, this is State Representative Mike Nierman. And so, for instance, somebody who's guilty of accounting fraud or something like that might be a felon, and yet they're not really a physical danger to society, and we have other reasons to exclude them. But so I don't know about that. I'm open on that one. If we could slice and dice and say certain felons aren't allowed to own guns and certain felons are. But I don't know. On the background check thing, the background checks, I'm okay with background checks. That's a tool that we have to make sure that the firearms don't end up in the wrong hands. But that it also raises some other issues. And I think we're this is a little sneak peek at what we might be coming up with in the next legislative session or the one after that, is what if the background check doesn't work? What if it doesn't go through? What if it's not able to connect Bob Smith, because his name's Bob Smith, and there's a lot of Bob Smiths? And so where does the presumption lie? Does the presumption lie on the side of Bob Smith to possess a firearm until the federal government can definitively say, no, Bob, you can't have a firearm because of these reasons? Or does the presumption lie on the fact of the government to say, no, mother may I, Bob Smith, you can't have a firearm until we're satisfied that you're okay? So that's one of the questions that we need to answer there, and it's one of the questions that keeps getting asked in the legislature. And I come down on the side of the right of the people to keep and bear arms. So if you can prove that I can't have a firearm, I'm okay with that. But if you can't prove it, then I think the presumption needs to be on the side of freedom.
Thank you.
Floyd Przanski, as I stated during my previous presentation, the law was established in 1925 by the legislature prohibiting all felons from having access at that point to concealable guns, which were basically handguns. That definition is pretty well stayed with us until it was expanded in 1989, where it went to all firearms. Clearly, the legislature look at laws and we make changes, we make modifications. What I haven't seen from any of my colleagues is an attempt to bring forward what they might think is a better definition or limitation or on which felons should or shouldn't have access to guns. I've actually made that recommendation to some of my colleagues that if they would like to see that, they should bring forward whatever they think is the appropriate bill. And the appropriate thing, and then we can have the debate and discussion. I personally, at this point, because of what has been established in 1925 and following the law that's there now, I also realize and understand that because of some of the positions I've taken, that whatever I might propose as a change in which felons should or shouldn't be prohibited from having guns is going to be, no pun intended, shot down by other individuals who are basically going to say, well, he's trying to reduce someone's rights. The reality is the courts have already established where the parameters are, and our state is actually doing taking those steps to ensure that those who are lawful have access to guns. Now, I think one of the things that you need to take in consideration is with the background check, yes, there are times, very limited times, where there may be something that's held up and doesn't go through immediately. But again, 20,000 per month are going through with no problem. 20,000. So, and if we're only, no one has shown me how many that there's that there is an equal number that are being held up. What normally happens, or what causes someone for having a hold place, is that they lived in a different state, they were arrested, but there's no disposition on their NCIC, which is a criminal background check, saying what happened. And so then our state has to reach out to the sister state and get the information to determine whether or not they're eligible or not. And some states do not respond as quickly. We have set up a procedure that you could, in fact, have an individual go to the other state, bring that material to our state to actually clarify it. So that's another means of doing it.
Thank you. We just have a few more minutes for questions. So one question that came up in an area that we haven't talked about yet is safe storage. One area in which there may be some agreement between the left and right is on safe storage. That's the requirement that unattended firearms be secured. Do you think a bill on this topic would be successful?
Again, Floyd Przanski, there have been numerous bills that have been filed trying to deal with the safe storage issues, and they have not been successful to date. There's been some discussion and debate as to trying to expand or that discussion and having us look at other means. There's been concepts as to requiring some type of safe or locking mechanisms for the triggers, and also requiring people to have insurance, liability insurance, just like you do for your vehicle, and also giving potentially tax credits for individuals who actually purchased a gun safe to give them an opportunity, because a gun safe isn't very cheap, but it's one of those situations that maybe we as a state should take that next step and making, we do a lot of tax credits for multiple different things, and maybe that's another way that we can help do that. I do believe that most of Oregonians are willing to look at this. I know that in my discussions with many family members and many parents, that they're now asking before their kids start going to someone's house, are there guns in the house? What steps are taking to maintain this, that they are safe? And I can only tell you from my childhood, my father had two handguns. I knew exactly where they were. In fact, they were in one of my, in the bedroom I moved into after they moved into the big new bedroom. And I actually pulled one of those down, which was a .22 revolver, pistol. And I basically was showing it to a friend. He says, is it loaded? And I said, no, it's not loaded. And I clicked it. It clicked. And then I opened up the stock, the hand, and guess what? It had a full magazine in there. Fortunately, Dad had not chambered one, or we would have had a hole through the house. So those are situations that we know kids actually know where you are keeping your guns. They, in many cases, know how to access those. And so we do need to have reasonable steps to prevent that, those type of unattended tragedies.
Thanks. And this is State Representative Mike Nierman. And I agree with much of what Senator Przanski said. That I think that there's an opportunity for, again, I'll do a commercial for education. So in the K-12 education system there, to have some sort of gun education component there. So I'd be fine with that. I'm not sure about mandating safe storage. That might be a little bit invasive and hard to control, but and if I'll agree with the tax credits for the gun safes, but you got to come up with the money for that. So.
Thank you. I have to say we have a few more questions that we don't have time to get to. We have multiple questions on automatic weapons, and both Representative and Senator have spoken a little bit about that. We also have several questions about domestic violence as being part of the gun issue, and they've also spoken about that. So I apologize sincerely to those of you whose questions we didn't get to, but we need to wrap it up, and hopefully Senator Przanski and Representative Nierman would have a few minutes afterwards if you want to speak with them. Before we thank our speakers, there's a couple quick announcements. We want to say thank you to public radio station KLCC 89.7 for airing City Club programs on Monday at 6:30 p.m. And thank you to Community Television of Lane County, Cable Channel 29, for televising recent City Club programs. Next week, we are off for Thanksgiving, but in 2 weeks, we will resume programming on Friday, December 1st. The program will be What You Need to Know About the Tech Industry in Eugene. More details and information about future programs can be found online at the City Club's website, cityclubofeugene.org. Now let's give a big thank you and round of applause to Mike Nierman and Floyd Przanski. Thank you. That concludes today's program.